The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has faced a lot of controversy. Now the death of a former deputy has added mystery to the equation. I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on Here and Now, I'll talk with reporter Jude Joffe Block about what was found in former deputy Charlie Armendariz's garage and how that could affect a racial profiling case against the sheriff's office. Plus, the push for federal immigration reform continues. This week, some House Republicans argued with each other over whether undocumented immigrants who serve in the U.S. military can earn a path to citizenship. Also, State Senator Steve Gallardo was running for Congress. That is, until he heard that former colleague Anna Tovar would not be a candidate for the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. So yesterday, Gallardo decided to run for that seat. What should we make of politicians who jump from race to race? And Amy Donahue made quite an impact online with Social Media Stole My Kidney. Now she's turning it into a documentary. We'll ask her about it. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, should serving in the U.S. military give undocumented immigrants the opportunity to get on a path to citizenship? Some members of Congress have been pushing that issue this week. Also, State Senator Steve Gallardo jumped from one race, the 7th Congressional District, to another, a seat on the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, presumably because he'd have a better chance of winning. Is that okay? I'll talk with consultant Jaime Molera. Plus, the Arizona Diamondbacks made a big hire over the weekend, bringing in Hall of Fame manager Tony La Russa to run their baseball operations. I'll ask team president Derek Hall why the move was made. And Amy Donahue started an online sensation with Social Media Stole My Kidney. We'll catch up with her as she's producing a documentary. We start today's program with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. The story of an MCSO deputy who was found dead earlier this month is getting stranger and stranger. A search warrant of Deputy Charlie Armendariz's home revealed not only drugs, but also a stash of IDs and driver's licenses and hundreds of hours of video footage he'd recorded himself making traffic stops. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block has learned about new revelations in the case from some recently unsealed court documents, and she joins me now in studio. So, Jude, this investigation is being overseen by Judge Murray Snow. People know him as the judge in the racial profiling case against Sheriff Arpaio. So explain that for us.
Well, first of all, it's worth mentioning that this isn't the first connection that Deputy Armendariz has to the racial profiling case. He was a player in that case. Two of the plaintiffs who brought that suit alleged that he had unlawfully detained them, so he actually had to testify in that trial. He was mentioned in Judge Snow's findings. So this is somebody who's already in the court record already. But what happened is when the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office realized when they initiated their investigation and found what Armendariz had allegedly been doing, they brought that information to the court-appointed monitor and to the attention of the judge. Because the judge has issued sweeping changes to the office and is really, the monitor is overseeing their operations, so this all became very relevant for that reason. And then there's the third reason, which is that Armendariz was filming himself making traffic stops, and that's the exact kind of evidence that would have really been exactly what would have been most useful, actually, in this case. But it doesn't seem like any of the parties or the judge knew that this kind of footage was available or existed. But this would have been very relevant to finding out, were they making proper traffic stops? Was race a factor in stopping people and using law enforcement decisions?
So what you're saying is it's very unlikely the higher-ups had any idea he was doing this? How weird is this that he was filming his own traffic stops?
What we found out from reading court transcripts, because there were a number of closed-door hearings about this initially that were only unsealed, and the transcripts were only unsealed on Friday. And so this is pretty new information for us. But in the last couple of weeks, there were some court hearings that dealt with this. And what came out is that it seems like MCSO did not have a policy about whether deputies could buy their own equipment and film themselves. And that seems like what Armendariz was doing. There were some agency-issued video cameras for cars, which he also had. But there didn't seem to be a policy necessarily for how to use those or how to collect that footage, or at least when Chief Deputy Sheridan was talking with the judge, he didn't know at that point where that footage was exactly. So it seems like this caught maybe the top brass by surprise, but maybe there were some supervisors who might have known. That's something that Judge Snow really wants to get to the bottom of. Were there other deputies who were also filming themselves? Is there more evidence about criminal activity that might have been going on, or even traffic stops that might be relevant? And so he's ordered the agency to try to recover all of the footage that might have been captured and make sure that other deputies might not sort of be tempted to destroy it if they think there might be something incriminating on it.
When this was first at least publicly uncovered, you and some of your journalist colleagues were not allowed in the courtroom at that point. What happened there? Why was Judge Snow so close-mouthed about this? Why did you have to leave?
On May 14th, a number of reporters showed up for what we thought was just going to be a hearing about payments from the county to the court-appointed monitor. But then what happened is that hearing ended, and suddenly Sheriff Joe Arpaio was there with an entourage, and it was clear that there was another hearing starting that hadn't been in the court record. And so all of the reporters were surprised by that. When we reconvened at 10 a.m. With the sheriff and with a few new faces, the judge said that there had been a motion to seal the courtroom because it had to do with an MCSO special operation. Now that the transcripts have been unsealed, they were unsealed just 2 days later, we know that it was because of the ongoing criminal investigation into Armendariz, and it had to do with this wanting to collect the video footage, I'm guessing, and so that they wanted to keep things under wraps because of the ongoing criminal investigation. The fact that Armendariz is now deceased is probably one reason why those documents have been unsealed so quickly.
Let's go back to Armendariz's stash that he had in his garage. When we hear about IDs, social security cards, what could possibly have been involved there? Why would he have had all this stuff in his garage?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the big question. I mean, there's no question that this is really unusual and bizarre. You know, there was a little bit of a clue at one point when, in the very first conversation, when MCSO lawyers brought this to the judge's attention, Judge Snow asked, well, is anyone investigating whether Armendariz might have been shaking down illegal aliens? I mean, and it's worth mentioning that almost half of the IDs that he had in his possession were Mexican issued. So Mexican driver's licenses, Mexican consular IDs, and certainly not all of them. Sort of the other half were Arizona driver's licenses and state IDs or out of state IDs as well. But it gives you a sense that there was maybe a disproportionate number of you know, foreign IDs in there. And so that said, and you know, when the judge asked that question, Chief Deputy Sheridan did say, you know, that suggested that could be a possibility, and so that was something that they were looking into. And he said, you know, but we're so surprised, why didn't we get any complaints about this? If that was the case, you know, to which plaintiffs have said, to which the ACLU of Arizona says, well, we know the complaint system is broken. That was part of what we were alleging in our case, is that there is mismanagement at this department, and that people who want to make complaints never really get to in a satisfactory way, or they're never really handled appropriately.
And Jude, finally, what's next for the investigation? How much intertwining can we possibly expect there to be more of with Armendariz and the overall racial profiling case?
It's certainly an unexpected twist. I mean, things were, I think, just starting to kind of gel a little bit right before this. You know, we had just had Murray Snow kind of have an order saying that the sheriff's office was in compliance, that they had followed something he had asked them to do, you know, something pretty simple, which was to send a message to all of their staff that they understood the order, a summary of the order, and they had followed that, and they're working with the monitor, and it seems sort of like, okay, well, things are going to kind of start going the way that we thought, get onto sort of some kind of normal footing and some kind of rhythm. And I think it's safe to say this has really shaken things up, because actually lawyers from the ACLU suggested that this is going to delay the briefing schedule now in the Ninth Circuit appeal. Because, of course, you know, the Arpaio's is appealing to the Ninth Circuit. Briefs are due for the plaintiffs. They say, you know, we're going to need more time because this does sort of change some of the arguments that we're going to make. And I think probably the defendants need a little bit of time to digest this as well. So that's one impact that we're already seeing. In terms of what's next, Judge Snow has ordered MCSO to share all of their investigation documents with the U.S. Attorney's Office and with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, with the idea that if those agencies did want to do their own kind of investigation, they should have that possibility. Because he's concerned, I mean, there's clearly potentially a conflict of interest here. MCSO might not want everything to come out. And we have heard from their lawyers that they hope very much that this is a rogue standalone case, that this is Armendar is working alone, that there won't be other deputies implicated. But of course, they are allowing for the fact that that might be a possibility. And they've said that they want to get to the bottom of this. And the judge has made very clear in court, he said to Arpaio, according to these court transcripts, it is your job as the sheriff to set the tone that the truth comes out no matter who it hurts.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, all over the MCSO story. Jude, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about immigrants serving in the military and the controversy over the Enlist Act. And then a little bit later on, we'll find out why certain politicians jump from race to race. Is it because they're more winnable? Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, announcing Encore Prizes for exceptional organizations that engage adults 50 plus in meeting community needs. Applications at pipertrust.org/encore.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. The Valley Forecast calling for sunny skies and a high today near 91. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with an overnight low in the upper 60s. Around the state right now, sunny skies and 59 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 68 in Prescott. Sunny and 82 degrees in Casa Grande. 87 degrees under sunny skies in Tucson. In Valley traffic, on the Red Mountain portion of the Loop 202, watch out for some debris in the roadway in both directions at Higley Road. Right now in Phoenix, it's mostly sunny and 83 degrees at 11:17.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Members of Congress have been fighting over immigration reform again this week, but the issue has been pretty specific, whether certain undocumented immigrants who serve in the U.S. military should be eligible for a path to citizenship. Representative Jeff Denham of California filed his bill, known as the Enlist Act, as an amendment to a sweeping defense policy measure that the House was considering this week. The measure would create a path to citizenship for so-called dreamers who were brought illegally to the U.S. as children and serve in the military. Denham says the bill provides an avenue for those who want to perform the ultimate act of patriotism. Opponents of Enlist argue that politicians are creating the wrong incentive by proposing military service in return for what critics call amnesty. Joining me for a few minutes is Michael Nazario, immigrant rights activist and community organizer, and himself a dreamer. Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today. What do you make of the Enlist Act? Is this something that seems very positive, or are you a little bit skeptical?
To be quite honest with you, I am very optimistic about this, actually. I know that in previous times, we have, as dreamers, lobbied our congressman, spoke up about our desire to want to serve our country. And I think at this moment in time, we are feeling optimistic in regards to having some form of legislation being passed in Congress. We are having a lot of support both from Democratic congressmen and some of our Republican congressmen. But what's most important is that we want to see some form of action, and this is the first step to ensure that we get that some form of legislation in favor of our community.
Michael, there are some who are concerned this idea of, on one side, some people are saying, well, offering so-called amnesty in exchange for military service. On another side, people are saying, well, are we putting immigrants in danger in exchange for citizenship, and is that troublesome? Are you concerned about either one of those sides?
Well, I don't consider this amnesty. This is not amnesty. What we're talking about is allowing certain youth, certain students that have been screened by the Department of Homeland Security. We're talking about those folks who have undergone already and earned their deferred action through this administration. And we're talking about students who are well qualified here. This is not a job. This is a further commitment that we already have made to our communities, and this is a further commitment to our country that we have at this moment.
Well, indeed, that is that commitment, but there are some, as well as I mentioned, who are worried about the fact that serving in the military, especially in recent times, has been an extremely dangerous proposition for some.
I understand. I think this comes back down to the personal choice and common vision that some of us as youth, as students have, some of our dreamers. There is a very small, I will say there is a small population of our dreamers who want to continue their education and definitely want to do that. And they actually desire to ensure that they have the opportunity to attend one of our senior military academies. And that's That's actually an amendment that was spoken about by one of the congressmen, by Congressman Castro. And this would allow our Dreamers to continue their education, be the officers of tomorrow. And we're also talking about having educators. And we want commissioned officers as well. And that's what we're looking for, to ensure that some of our youth do progress through the ranks with a great education as well.
Michael, one other question for you. There's been so much talk about comprehensive immigration reform, and some were concerned about what they're calling a piecemeal approach. If something like the Enlist Act were to pass, are you pleased by that, or are you also concerned at the same time that maybe that would make it more difficult for a more comprehensive package?
It's been actually a couple of years now since we've been all fighting for comprehensive immigration reform. As I stated earlier, this is a commitment that we have towards our country and towards our community, our immigrant families. This is a first step. This is a first step to ensure that we enact further legislation. We would love to see this happen and have a standalone bill possibly come up in Congress. If the majority leader decides to move forward with this, if Speaker Boehner decides to move forward, this is great. But I think at this moment in time, our immigrant community has been waiting too long, and we need to see some form of action from Congress.
Michael Nazario, immigrant rights activist, community organizer, and a dreamer himself. Michael, thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
And joining me now as well to talk about immigrants serving in the military is former U.S. Army Captain Brett Hunt, who is National Veterans Coordinator of Veterans for Immigration Reform. Brett, let's talk first about legal immigrants, folks who have decided once they've come to this country legally to make that commitment. I know you have some numbers related to that. What can you tell us?
Well, Steve, first of all, thanks so much for having me here today to have this important discussion. You know, I think it's important right off the bat that we put this in context. And if we look back at our history, immigrants have played a critical role in our nation's history and particularly in our nation's defense. If we look all the way back to the Revolutionary War on the Green at Lexington, on that battlefield, there were immigrants there at Shiloh, at Bellawood, Iwo Jima, Da Nang, Chosin Reservoir, Baghdad, and today in Kabul, there are immigrant soldiers serving this nation, individuals who were born under a foreign flag but who have chosen to serve this nation. When we look at the actual numbers, today we have about 30,000 legal permanent residents, green card holders, who are serving in the United States military. These are individuals who, in a time of war, have chosen to serve this nation, not people that were compelled to do so, but who have chosen to come and serve this nation. If we look back to, say, the Civil War, about a quarter of the Union Army were immigrants at that time. So there is a great and grand legacy of immigrant service to the United States military.
Well, it seems like the Enlist Act then, at least considering Dreamers, would be a logical next step. Do you think that is a logical next step?
I think the Enlist Act, and first of all, I'd like to start by applauding Representative Denham on his leadership on immigration. The Enlist Act, House leaders recognize that our broken immigration system is just way too broad to address in a single amendment to a defense reauthorization bill. You know, if the amendment is not included in the final bill as expected, that does nothing to halt the need for immigration reform. The complexities of what is wrong with our immigration system are just way too broad to address in a single bill like the Enlist Act, although I do applaud the leadership of Representative Denham on trying to address this difficult issue.
But when it comes down to folks who have some sort of status, as the Dreamers do, is there something that does it make sense to keep them from wanting to serve this country? In this case, a choice they were not able to make themselves. I mean, does that sound confusing to you as it does to me?
You know, I think there's a deep desire, and Michael, I think, spoke very eloquently to that. There's a deep desire by immigrants to serve their adopted nation. And that goes back in our nation's history. You know, my grandfather was a first-generation American. His family is from Italy. And I remember growing up hearing his great stories of how proud he was to have had the ability to serve in the Pacific during World War II and serve this nation. I think that intent is still there. If you give me just 1 second to tell a story about a young immigrant and I think the import of the sacrifices that are being made on the ground. In 2007, I was a vice consul down in Guadalajara, Mexico, at the U.S. Consulate General in Guadalajara. And a family came in to travel to a funeral, a father and several cousins. They were traveling to California for the funeral of Victor Toledo Pulido, Victor was born in Guadalajara, illegally immigrated to the United States, went to high school, worked, became a legal permanent resident, graduated from high school, got married, had a child, and enlisted in the U.S. Army as an infantryman. He deployed in March of 2007 to Baghdad. Mm. His unit was sent on a mission to recover a vehicle that had been hit by an IED. They successfully completed their mission, and on the way back in from that mission, they hit another IED, and Victor Toledo Pulido was killed. His commander, Captain Troy Thomas, said this to the LA Times: "It's hard to explain the rush of emotion at a time of like that. People should not have to experience that feeling. It's because of brave human beings like Victor that war is only witnessed by a few so the majority can live free and never experience what I felt that day. What does it take to prove your worth as an American? Well, if you ask me, Victor Toledo Pulido showed his worth by serving his nation and his family." I think the important point there is that Victor Toledo Pulido and millions like him, they did not come to this country to do harm. They came to this country to serve and defend this nation. And many of them have made that final sacrifice in these two wars. Over 100 legal permanent residents have died in defense of this nation. I see it as our duty to reform this broken immigration system, something that has broad support, bipartisan support, and particular support within the Republican Party. It's our duty to those who have made that sacrifice to reform the system. There are many immigrants whose families are negatively impacted by the current broken immigration system, individuals who are deployed to Afghanistan today who have family members here at home who are in deportation proceedings or who are dealing with serious immigration issues related to their status. We have a broken immigration system. It's broadly understood and accepted, and we're urging action on immigration reform this summer.
Brett, we have less than a minute or so, but I want to get your take. Since you're with Veterans for Immigration Reform, what is the special message that veterans can put out to make it clear that this should happen? I mean, is this a group that is being listened to by members of Congress?
It is. We are going to be doing several events. We did a great event over at Arizona State University. We'll be doing events in Chicago, South Carolina, Texas, and back in D.C. over the coming weeks. And the message is, when we swore an oath to the Constitution, it didn't matter who was to the left and the right of you in the bunker. You worked together towards a common goal. We want Washington and Congress to do the same thing. Look to the left, look to the right, and get this done. We urge action on immigration reform.
Former U.S. Army Captain Brett Hunt, National Veterans Coordinator of Veterans for Immigration Reform. Brett, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Yesterday, State Senator Steve Gallardo made the official announcement that he won't be running in Arizona's 7th Congressional District. Instead, he's jumping into the race to succeed Mary Rose Wilcox on the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. With me to talk about politicians running for different offices is Jaime Molera of the Government and Public Affairs firm Molera Alvarez. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jaime, what do you make of this, and what should voters make of this? Not just Senator Gallardo, but other folks who do this.
Well, I think a lot of times the reality of a campaign buttresses against the ambition of running for that office, and meaning that when they have great designs and they think they can give a great speech and they think they can rally people to their cause, if you don't have the money and organization to back that up, to get out to the broader audience, and nowadays with the need for mass media, to get on TV, to get on radio, to be able to do, you know, significant amounts of mailing, direct mail pieces, it's really hard to cut through. And so when you don't have that, then all of a sudden I think there's a realization when you see some poll numbers that, tend to give you a dose of reality, they start thinking about, well, what are other positions I can do?
What struck me in this case was the idea that Senator Gallardo seemed to make his jump right after Ana Tovar announced she was not going to run for that seat. So it really looked like musical chairs. Is it okay for politics to be that transparent?
Well, you know, it's one of those where I think the opportunity arose so that if you looked at, and from what I understand, any polling data that's out there, independent and even internal polls, showed that he was running a very distant third to Ruben Gallego and Mary Rose Wilcox. And if there's a chance to save face a little bit and say, well, you know, look, I'd rather be here in Maricopa County. I'd rather serve the residents of Maricopa County, and this is a better fit for me. Whether or not, I mean, that's true or not, that's, you know, only Steve can say. But at the same time, it was a good opportunity for him to show, well, here's another option for me.
Any reason to think this would hurt Steve Gallardo, this idea that people expected him to run for Congress? Would his supporters be disappointed he decided to jump to something else?
Well, and this has happened to others that have midstream have said they're going to run for a particular position and then run for something else. So it's not unique in Arizona. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it's happened in my recent memory at least 3 or 4 times for different races. It can hurt, especially if you're running against an opponent that's already there. You know, of course, they're going to make the case that they're running as a carpetbagger type, or they're just being opportunistic, or they couldn't compete, so now all of a sudden they're trying to run for a different position. Sure, it could be, if the opposition does a good job of framing that, it could hurt a campaign.
And, Jaime, should it matter what the position is? We're obviously talking about Steve Gallardo, but actually Vernon Parker popped to mind for me as well, someone who had run for Congress, had talked about running for governor, and now is running for Corporation Commission, which to an outsider seems like a real complicated office, and it seems like someone shouldn't just sort of jump into that willy-nilly. Does it matter what office it is? Should that affect how voters view it in terms of whether someone should bring a certain expertise?
Well, of course, the people that jump from office to office, they will make the argument, well, this was a better fit for me. That's why I'm doing this particular maneuver. But in reality, I think anybody that's in and around politics, if you were running for a particular position and you were way ahead in the polls and it looked like you were the best person for running for, like, say, you Arizona treasurer in that particular instance, then the question would be, well, why would you pull out when you had the money and organization and you were a front runner, then all of a sudden you're running for a different position? It's hard to make that case because usually, you know, I would say 9 times out of 10 or maybe 99 times out of 100, it's usually the opposite. It's people that are running very far back in the polls, and they decide, well, this is something that it will allow me to do something else, and I can be more competitive, or I have a better chance of winning.
Jaime, finally, does this mean that before a candidate gets into a race, he or she should think more closely about it? How often, as well, is it about what the candidate thinks and what some of his or her counselors might advise?
Well, I've seen many a time where people will run for an office. And you have to understand, anybody that runs for public office has an ego. Yeah, I think you have to. It's inherent in the job description. You got to have a big ego to say, you know, I think I can do a better job than anybody else, and I think that tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands or millions of people will vote for me because they think I'm the best person for that job. So you got to have the ego. But you also have to have money and organization. And with that money and organization or an ability to put it together comes a sense of what consultants are telling you that is truthful versus what consultants are telling you in order for them to get a job. Mm. And that's pretty prevalent. A lot of consultants I've seen give possible candidates polling data that says, see, you know, this type of candidate would win. You'd be fantastic. You pay us a certain amount a month and next thing you know, you're going to be the next congressman. Well, doesn't always work out that way because their polling data wasn't very good. They didn't use a reputable pollster, or they just are you know, blowing smoke up that person. And so a lot of times candidates really have to be honest with themselves, get people that are not yes people, and trust individuals that aren't just looking at it for their own benefit, but really, really believe that he or she is going to be the best person for that job.
I mean, you've done something amazing on a beautiful Wednesday morning. You've made me even more cynical than I was before. Thank you. Jaime Molera of the government and public affairs firm, Molera Alvarez. Jaime, thanks as always.
You're very welcome, Steve. Take care.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about the Diamondbacks' move to bring in big-name Tony La Russa, and we'll talk with Amy Donahue. Social media stole her kidney. We'll get details coming up.
KJZZ is supported by Dignity Health. Proud to introduce Norton Thoracic Institute at Dignity Health St. Joseph's Hospital, a new era of lung, heart, and esophageal care. More about the Institute at dignityhealth.org/thoracic.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. The Valley forecast calling for sunshine and a high near 91 degrees today. Cloudy skies tomorrow, our high will be 92, and the clouds will continue in the Valley for the next couple of days with highs of 91 on Friday and 90 on Saturday. Coming up at 12 o'clock, join us for NPR's Here and Now. After the heaviest rains in 120 years, floodwaters are finally receding in Bosnia and Serbia. And Pennsylvania has become the latest state to have its ban on same-sex marriage struck down. You can hear NPR's Here and Now from Boston coming up at noon. Mostly sunny skies, and it's 83 degrees in Phoenix at 11:35.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Over the weekend, the Arizona Diamondbacks took a dramatic step in the midst of a below-average season. Usually, teams will fire the manager or general manager. The Diamondbacks instead hired someone new to oversee the management team that's already in place. The man they hired is universally considered one of the greatest managers in baseball history, Tony La Russa.
You know, my heart's pure and my intentions are great and do the best I can. And I just think when you work with really good people, we're going to improve. Looking forward to the challenge.
La Russa will be in the newly created position of Chief of Baseball Operations. His boss will be Team President Derek Hall. I spoke with Hall earlier and asked him how long the hiring process took.
You know, about a month ago I started looking at options for us just because we were so disappointed and frustrated in the results and didn't want to be knee-jerk, but just had to put pencil to paper and look at all of our options. You know, in regards to our manager and general manager, you know, did we want to keep them? Did we want to move one? To move both? And the option of keeping them was addition rather than subtraction, and that's bringing in a elder statesman like Tony, who's got so much success and so much experience, and he's passionate, and he's a proven winner, and he's driven. It was just perfect for this scenario, and we reached out to Tony probably about 3 weeks ago. The initial conversation we had in person was about 3 hours, and I knew at that moment he was the right guy for this mission.
Usually in sports, it's the general manager or the equivalent, the manager, which is the way you had it before. Will people be less inclined, more inclined, you think, to want to join the organization, knowing they'll have not just you above them, but also Tony La Russa?
No, I don't think so, and it's not so odd to see it in baseball. There's a few teams like the Cubs and the Red Sox who are currently in a very similar situation. They just have different titles. I think I'm the first to name that position chief baseball officer, but I think when you have someone of Tony's caliber out there willing to get back in the competition and be with a team on a daily basis, why not be the ones to go and grab him? And I know a lot of teams have come his way. The scenario wasn't ideal for him or the structure wasn't ideal for him, and this one he really liked, and so I'm very happy that he joined us. And I think people, you know, my phone has increased phone calls, the emails, the texts, because people do want to work with Tony. And, you know, he's just so well-respected. That was one of the things in the due diligence. You look at him and everywhere he's been, be it in Chicago or Oakland or St. Louis, owners that he worked for, players that played for him, coaches that worked for him, there is such a strong loyalty in every one of those groups. I mean, he is just ideal.
And a lot of people have compared it to the Knicks hiring Phil Jackson, one of the greatest basketball coaches. Tony La Russa, obviously one of the best managers. Does that necessarily mean he's going to be good at running the organization?
We certainly hope so. I mean, he knows baseball. He's been in baseball 50 years, and he managed for 33 years. And part of being a manager was structuring and having input on those rosters that were created with his general managers. And so he knows what the job of a general manager entails. He doesn't want to be the GM, and he doesn't want to be the manager. He's just going to be a strong influence on both. And it is a little bit confusing and challenging right now for the general manager in place. It's going to, you know, take a little time as we get through this and they feel each other out and see just how the communication will flow and how the responsibilities will be handled. Yet I could see the general manager's duties being almost exactly what they are at this point. It's just now, you know, allowing Tony to make those decisions for us.
Do you wish you'd made this move in the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, you never want disruption, you know, in a season. I mean, that's for sure. And I think even if we were at, say, 500 or above 500 right now, the move would still make sense. To be able to bring in Tony La Russa as your chief baseball officer is a strong move, and hopefully it works in our favor. But I think, yes, if I had thought about it, I certainly had, you know, higher expectations, and we've had some bad luck. This is not all placed on any one, two, or three people. You know, we've had bad luck, we've had injuries, and we just had a horrible first month for whatever reason. But it feels like we're starting to get out of this and get ourselves out of that hole that we dug, and we've you know, we've gotten to 10 games under 500 now, and we've won four of our last five series, and the team is playing better. I think they definitely responded to the hiring of Tony. He spent time in the clubhouse Sunday before the game talking to the players, and again, they put together two really good games against the Dodgers after the announcement, so I hope it will have some sort of effect, but we have to be realistic. We know that this team is not going to completely turn around just because of the hiring of one individual. It's going to take time for him to evaluate, assess, and make the recommendations that he's going to make to turn things around.
Is there a perception of the organization? Even Ken Kendrick mentioned it last week or over the weekend, this idea that you've produced so many talented players. You have a great farm system, and yet it seems like some of the wrong guys were dealt. Is that a consistent thing? There was impatience there?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, Steve, and I think it's also a general manager who was going for it. You know, he wanted to win now, and I can't blame him for that. You win the division in 2011, and you get to the playoffs, and expectations, you know, rose, and we didn't perform so well the next 2 years. We didn't have losing seasons, but we didn't win like we expected to. And then the struggles that we had, you know, make you look back and reflect on deals that have been made. You could do that with any GM and any team, and you're gonna find deals that didn't work out. That's just the nature of the business. So I don't put all of this on Kevin or on our general manager or his baseball operations staff. And I can tell you, all they've tried to do is win. The only thing that Kevin has wanted to do is win so bad for the fans and for us. And I don't fault him at all for trying. And he wasn't working alone, you know. So it's some did not work out, but I can tell you there's plenty that did.
Derek, our pro sports teams, I think this has been something, if people follow the big four sports, this has been more of a hockey thing where changes are made when teams don't advance far enough in the playoffs, and even guys are maybe only given a year or two to make things turn. Do you think baseball is going that way? Is there a feeling that there are no more five-year plans?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that way in sports in general. You know, it's a unique business. It's a strange business in that we are results driven, and we're in the results business. And if they're not that good, it seems like change is needed. And that's, you know, that's just the that's the sport that we're in. Not just baseball, though. I would say in really all the sports, there's a bit of an impatience and a bit of high expectation, no matter what market you're in, or no matter what sport you have, or you're a part of. But it's because everybody is so passionate about their teams. You know, we in our positions are fans as well, just like the fans of our team that are watching us each and every game. I mean, this is a passionate sport and business. And I think everybody that gets into the sport understands the risk involved, and especially in a managerial or general managerial position.
Derek, finally, and this is specific to the Phoenix area, did the Diamondbacks, to other organizations in this market, need to make big splashes with big names? Let's say there's someone who's less well-known than Tony La Russa, but also had a pretty amazing resume. Is it better to go with La Russa because that'll get fans more excited?
Well, I think you have to do what you think is best for the team. Of course, you know, you would like nice press associated with it and a nice response from the fans, but that shouldn't be the driving factor. It should really be who's best for the situation at hand and who can set us up for a sustained level of success. And, you know, I just think Tony is that guy. He just happens to be one of the highest respected, most respected, individuals in our game and considered one of the brightest minds in our game. But I think it's more than that. You know, he's somebody who I think is fully capable. I think he exudes leadership and knows how to win, and that's why he was the perfect guy to be announced for us.
Derek Hall, President and CEO of the Diamondbacks. Derek, thank you.
Steve, thank you.
But the Diamondbacks' big splash with the hiring of Tony La Russa isn't the only one Valley teams have made over the years. The Suns once traded for Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal. The Diamondbacks signed Randy Johnson. For some insight on what the Phoenix sports scene is really like, I turn to Todd Walsh of Fox Sports Arizona, who's covered the games and personalities for a couple of decades. He is in St. Louis right now. Todd, good morning and good afternoon.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
And as Tom Brenneman would say, good night, but I'm not going to say that right now.
Please don't. No, thank you.
Todd, is this a market, Phoenix, that needs its teams not just to win, but to be especially fun and interesting too?
I mean, I think you'd say that, Steve, about any market. It was interesting to hear Derek Hall and his take on that. And I just looked to the Tony La Russa example. The reason that splash was made wasn't because of just the name. It's because of the equity and the reputation that he brings to it. Now, certainly along the way, we've seen teams try to go for the big play, like you brought up the Shaquille O'Neal. But I think this was a decision made solely on what Tony brings to the table, and then you're seeing a reaction. And the other thing is, you're also seeing, and this is going to, you're going to see this now, I think, across the board in pro sports. We've seen it a bit in baseball, hockey. There was a proliferation of it this year. There's a new position being created, a new management model where there's a guy above the GM and below the owner. And I actually love it. I think what you're seeing now is guys are coming back to the game that have great insight, great connections, and they have won and tasted great success, and now they're adding yet another direction to these teams. And when you consider the amount of money now that these players have made along the way, they don't need to come back and manage. That's the problem. The really good guys, they've made so much money, they don't ever have to work again. And they don't want the day-to-day grind. They don't want to deal with the winning and losing and the media and all the other stuff. And same thing for some of those guys in the general manager ranks. Well, now you can come in and guide it, but you don't have to sit there and live and die with every single move. And I think that's a great turn in pro sports. Hockey was sort of leading the way and with what they were doing, bringing back some of the great stars of the last era of players, and look what the Diamondbacks have done with Tony La Russa. So I think that's where you're going, and I understand your angle on it completely, but this wasn't a splash. This is a bold step, a very, very bold step, and also recognition that things were not going the way they wanted them to go. That's my sense of it.
Todd, your perspective's interesting, because I always wonder whether that's, even with a Tony La Russa, it sounds like it could be too many cooks, but you're saying you're not afraid of that.
No, I'm not. I don't know how this is going to play out. I certainly have a sense of how it may wind up going. I think Tony's going to take his time and do his due diligence, and I read a great thing today about he needs to do this at 30,000 feet looking down on it. I think he's going to do that. I think we can make some assumptions on who might fit, who might not fit. I don't know that's going to be the case tomorrow. I don't know when that might happen. I think in any business, when they bring in new leadership, that ultimately people are going to fall by the wayside. That's just the course of natural human nature. So this team wasn't winning. I mean, it's just amazing to me. I just get a quick sense of this in my own litmus test. I got on a plane. I flew by myself to St. Louis 2 days ago. Before we were at 30,000 feet, there was almost an impromptu sports talk show in my aisle. Somebody recognized me, and the first question was, is he going to manage? I thought it was a friend of mine. I turned around, I'm like, and then two people started talking, and I realized right away, you know what, people still have an investment in their teams. They're, you know, bad teams, bad moments are like car wrecks, and that's the one thing I always encourage the teams that I cover. You guys need to understand that when you don't play well, there is drama to that, and people are even more in tune to what's going on. So you better react, and you better think accordingly. Don't just assume that because you're not playing well, people don't care anymore. They care, I think, even more.
Mm.
So that's my bizarre look at it. I've had the best seat in the house for a long time, and I sense that.
Todd, you're closely identified with the Coyotes, and this La Russa move sort of reminded me of a hockey move, in the sense that the NHL seemed to be the first sport to expect really fast turnarounds. And I did ask Derek Hall about whether the so-called five-year plan is out the window. Do you feel like that is happening more in sports? And is that a bad thing as the folks give in to the impatience of the fans?
I think it's more impatience with the owners. I think that's probably what you're sensing, is that owners want to get it now. They just want now, and you know, the five-year gentle plan, I think that just goes by the wayside now in the world that we live in, with social media and instant communication, and everybody knows everything about every single second of a game that just transpired by the time the game ended. I remember I had to wake up the next morning to really look at a box score if the paper came on time or if it got taken away by the snowplow. I mean, that's the life I remember living, and it wasn't that long ago. I'm sitting here looking up a box score from the first major league game I ever attended in 1976 here in St. Louis. I can do it in 2 seconds. Literally, I'm looking at it going, oh yeah, Bake McBride, he had a couple of hits. When I was 12, I can't even imagine doing that. So I think that's all part of the process. Now, the Coyotes, I think, fell in love with the Wayne Gretzky thing, and I think that ownership group thought they were going to get instant gratification from it. They didn't. People don't come to watch coaches. They come to watch players, and they come to watch winning. That's the bottom line. Wayne was a figurehead. It was interesting. He signed some autographs. People looked at him on the bench sort of as a curiosity, but then they got mad at him because he didn't deliver.
Mm.
So it comes down to that to me. I mean, if you're winning, let's just start right there, then your fans are going to show up. And then if you got some interesting personalities, they're going to show up even more. And then if the media does the job and your partners do the right job in telling the stories and making it compelling and getting up close and personal, to borrow an old phrase, even more people will come. And then if you lose a big playoff series and people are heartbroken, they're going to want to come back. I mean, I've seen this cycle for a quarter of a century. It's why I'm still doing this with gray hair and glasses. Because I personally enjoy watching that. And then you get those couple of runs where you'll never forget them. The 93 Suns, I'll never forget. 2001 Diamondbacks. Never forget it. 97 Arizona Wildcats. I get chills talking to you about it. But in between, there's all kinds of wins and losses that fall by the wayside. But it's those three that you hang on to. It's like a great golf shot that makes you want to go out and play the next day.
Todd Walsh of Fox Sports Arizona joining us from St. Louis. The Diamondbacks are playing the Cardinals tonight at 5. You can see it on Fox Sports Arizona. Todd, thanks as always.
Thanks for calling, Steve. It was always a pleasure talking to you. You guys are the best.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. About a year ago, we introduced you to Amy Donahue, who generated a lot of buzz online with Social Media Stole My Kidney. It was her story of donating a kidney to a complete stranger because of Twitter. She's become an advocate for organ donation, has been working on a documentary. Amy is here with director James Petragallo to talk with us again. Amy, good morning.
Hi.
So give us just the Cliff's Notes version to say it better than I did. tell us about how social media stole your kidney.
About 3.5 years ago, I saw a tweet from a woman. We had been following each other for about a year, and I knew her mom was sick. She was having a conversation with another mutual friend about her mom finally agreeing to be put on the organ donor list, and I jumped in and said, I'll do it. I'll donate my kidney. What do I have to do? So that was April 19th, 2011, I donated. And then just about 2 years ago to the day, I ran into Jimmy at a show and I said, hey, you know, I've been thinking about making this documentary to drive around the country and meet other kidney donors to raise awareness. And without hesitation, he was in. And we drove about almost 8,000 miles last year, May, to film the movie.
I want to ask James more specifics about the movie, but one more question for you. When you went out and met all these people, these are people who received donations, were donors as well?
They were all donors okay. who I met mostly via groups on Facebook, but
did they want to talk to you, Amy?
I never had anybody who didn't want to talk to us because as organ donors, we're huge champions for the cause because we were fine. You know, we were healthy, and without hesitation, everybody we asked in the film if they would do it again, everybody said, yeah, within seconds.
James, what do you want this movie to look like? What does it look like at this point?
Well, at this point, it looks like a timeline of lots of disassembled chunks at this point. But honestly, we want it to be, I don't know anything about the kidney world or anything like that. I'm a comedian. She approached me with this. So basically, I wanted to make this accessible to people who aren't already involved in this world. Make it funny, make it entertaining, and also, you know, obviously informative and get people to want to do this sort of thing.
Yeah, you're talking about making people laugh, but you also, I mean, people are affected by so many things when it comes to the emotions. Mm-hmm. I want to have you both talk about what are some things that you heard that maybe you didn't expect to hear, or some things that really affected you more, whether in terms of laughter or tears?
For me personally, our third day filming, I think we were in L.A., and we spoke with Jenna.
Yes.
Jenna, a girl.
And Carol.
And Carol, her is her mother, and Carol's a big advocate, and Jenna actually needs a kidney, and I believe she needs a second kidney. She's really, really having a lot of problems, and they were so emotional about it. And that's when it really, you know, kind of struck like, wow, this is a life and death thing. And it's not just an issue. It's a real, this is a real person sitting here crying, begging for her life. And that really hit me right in the gut.
And what about you?
You know, for me, the entire trip was finally meeting people who I knew. And I get choked up when I watch the trailer. I get choked up right now just thinking about the connections that we made. But I'd have to reiterate what James said, speaking to someone who was on dialysis, because my recipient never went on dialysis. She controlled everything with a very strict diet. That day was pretty tough for both of us, but it was very emotional.
How did you know you made the right call? I mean, did you know... Were you convinced that things were going to work out okay for you and the woman? What was the nickname you gave to the
Tiny Mom?
Right. but how excited or how nervous were you once you'd made that decision?
Well, I had been through a lot during the testing process. I had lost my job. We had a lot of good and bad publicity. I just wanted it over with, frankly. I wheeled in and I told the Today Show and I swore and I said, get that blank camera out of my face. I was done. I just wanted it over with. I wanted her to be healthy. And I didn't get to see her until the next day. Mm. And she's doing very well right now.
So as far as the people you talked to on the road when you and James were out filming this, did you hear from people who had doubts and concerns that were unfamiliar to you? Were you hearing things that maybe you felt for a couple of seconds but didn't? Because, I mean, you're, as much as you'd been through, the fact with your comic background and whatnot, I think people feel like you can find some way to joke about things, whereas people who in other situations maybe can't. Did you find that as well? I mean, did you find that it took them a while or a little bit longer to adjust to the situation than you?
I don't think so, because everyone had such an amazing sense of humor. We have comedian Alonzo Bowden in the film. So, like, there was a lot of fun, too. And when we stopped in Detroit, we actually performed that night with the donor in Detroit, okay, who does comedy.
Right.
These people are all very spunky. They're all really, like, they had spirit. Like, all of them had a certain, there was a certain through line there of a certain spirit, which I guess you could understand for people that would just go out of their own volition and do something like that.
So. Well, how many people did you guys interview?
Oh, God, what was it?
14.
14 is what I thought, too, so we'll say
and
14.
How many do you expect to actually be in the movie, and how many on the cutting room floor?
Right now, they're all in there.
Okay.
But we're in a rough cut.
But it's a so seven-hour director's cut.
Yeah, that's going to be a really long one. It's going to be like Godfather whole series together, so.
So, do you have a vision right now for how you want the structure to play out, where you want the narrative to go?
That's what we're playing with right now, is the narrative and kind of just how we want to present it. But generally, yeah, I have a kind of a thing that I'm doing and putting it together. And yeah, I have a plan at this point, a plan of attack to get this thing all finally put together.
Just without giving away too much, James, I wouldn't ask you that. Is it a linear approach? Is it something you feel like, okay, we don't really want to go timeline, we want to try something a little bit different?
Yeah, we're going to, it's a little bit, we're going to jump around a little bit, and we're going to, I'm going to intercut a lot too. I found old movies that have, like, from the 50s, public domain movies from, like, you know, the transplanted brain, and like people are freaking out about transplants. So just kind of to show how ridiculous, that's how people think of transplanting, a lot of people. So, you know, we're just kind of try to put a light on that, if that's ridiculous, and make it, this is reality, and show these people.
So, Amy, if you can, take us back. This is post-donation now, but like right after the donation and your life now, how has it changed?
Oh my God, I don't even know how, if I could put that all together. I mean, I just felt like I couldn't stop as far as talking about it and getting it out there, because when you have a Twitter follower who says, I'm donating in 2 weeks because of you, and I had... last night I got a message on Facebook from a guy who's in the kidney world, and he said, oh, I just showed my wife the trailer. Can you email her because she wants to donate now? Mm. When those kinds of things happen, you keep going, and I'm a monster. I seriously am. I'm like the kidney beast out there, and you can't stop me from talking about it because it changed my life, and it gave me a purpose. I don't have kids. So this is my baby. This is, when you have kids, you leave a legacy of raising amazing human beings. And the kidney donation and everything since then, that's my legacy. That's what I want to be known for.
James, last thing for you then. What's the journey been like to, as you said, to be a total novice when it comes to donations or organ donation, and now you've been through this with Amy?
It was 0 to 60 very quickly. It went from I know nothing to people telling us their most intimate medical details and me taking it all in, and it's been a crash course. But now I could probably be a kidney doctor just tomorrow if you just let me out there. I could probably fake my way through it for a day. I think I know that much at this point, but it's been interesting, I'll say
that. And finally, if things work out well with funding and whatnot, what's the timeline you guys are hoping for to have this all done?
We'd like to have it done. We're going to go to festivals next year, 2015 festivals. We want to give ourselves enough time to really, really cut it correctly and all that. We have 85 hours of footage, so it's just a jumble. So,
okay.
We want festivals next year. Start with Sundance, South by Southwest, and hopefully we'll get into something like that. So,
James Petragallo, Amy Donahue. You know Amy from social media, Stole My Kidney. Guys, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to today's edition of Here and Now. Thanks to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond. If you want to hear this program again or one of our previous episodes, go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app. Now it's time to head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.